Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, on here, 5 hours a week with 5+ guests telling hard truths rarely heard in the corporate mainstream. Today, we're going to go a little bit local and talk about Wisconsin libertarian matters as well as the usual cosmic matters that we talk about here on Truth Jihad Radio with Robert Burke. Robert Burke was a libertarian candidate for governor of Wisconsin in 2014. He's the chair of the Libertarian Party in Pierce St. Croix County. And I have a bit of a history with the Libertarian Party as well. I was a Libertarian candidate for Congress in 2008. So we're inhabiting the same world where Robert is working on getting the Libertarians to pass a resolution calling for a genuine investigation of what happened to Building 7. And he's a financial services wholesaler who got started in that business right after 9/11. And let's talk about that. You know, I remember on 9/11, my first thought was, this looks pretty weird. You know, I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin at the time, and class ended a little early, and I was kind of suspicious. My first thought was, you know, the Israelis are going to make out like bandits from this. This is exactly what they want. I wonder if those 19 guys were brainwashed by the Mossad. That was my first reaction. But it took me 2 years then of kind of hemming, hawing, and not really getting it to sit down and take a hard look at what happened on 9/11. And when I did at the end of 2003, I haven't stopped since because I just discovered that this was the most outrageous act of mass murder and high treason in human history, and that it was going to destroy our country if people didn't do anything about it. Well, Robert, so tell us a little bit about how you got on this path to raising questions about Building 7 and everything that implies.
Well, first, Kevin, thank you very much for having me on your show. It's an honor to be able to speak with individuals openly about what happened on 9/11. I actually began wholesaling about a month before 9/11 happened. In fact, I was in Appleton, Wisconsin, getting ready to go to a Smith Barney office and talk about our product. I worked with financial services. And so I was really starting to learn about markets and really paying more attention to what happened on a global basis. And I remember, 9/11 is one of these moments where I think, you know, probably like our parents and our grandparents, we remember where they remember where they were when John F. Kennedy was shot. And I think we all remember where we were on 9/11. And it was one of these moments in time that captured everyone's attention, and for a very good reason. As you said, we had these mass murders of over 3,000 people that died. And this is probably one of the toughest parts about this entire issue, is that everybody wants to believe that we know what happened on 9/11, that the investigations that were done in completeness, that they were done with willful skill, that they were done to try and find out what the truth was. And over the years, there are many of us who have begun to wake up to what's going on. And so what I'm doing is I'm at the early side of working with the Libertarian Party to understand that this is actually a political issue, in particular in what happened with Building 7. I mean, you know, we can argue whether or not the tapes show that a plane flew into Building 1 or flew into Building 2, and I have no interest in starting those conversations. But what really captures the attention of skeptics is Building 7. And I'm working to get the Libertarian Party to understand that we need to begin representing the people of the state and the people of the country who do not believe that there is a full disclosure on what happened on 9/11. And it's important. Politics, is simply put, is the allocation of scarce resource. And we want more resources into the investigation itself. So on 9/11, you know, like many people, I was standing in a hotel in Appleton, Wisconsin. I watched, it must have been one little, you know, airplane that maybe was thinking it was flying between the buildings for fun. And it was a completely changing event. I remember standing there when somebody said, this is going to change everything. And it did. And it did in such a fundamental way that I think it bears bringing up that we need to take some time every once in a while and look back and ask ourselves, have we really done the right thing here? And I don't think that we have.
Well, I agree completely. And I think this is a really good issue for the Libertarian Party. And I've made this point talking to Libertarian groups a number of times, including in 2006, I talked to the Madison Libertarians. And there was one guy in this group who was totally not sold on what I was saying. And, you know, and he'd never heard of Building 7 at the time. So I told him all about Building 7. His name was Rolf Lindgren. Mm-hmm. And you know, a couple of months later, I got a call from him, and he looked into Building 7, and now he was a rabid truther, and he has been ever since. Libertarians, of course, are the party of very rigorous application of a philosophy of limited governance. That is, you know, the knowledge that the political system is largely a kind of authoritarianism or tyranny that takes away the free will to make free and voluntary contracts, and that, you know, we always have to keep an eye on government to prevent the tyranny that's inherent in government from getting worse. And 9/11 made it so much worse and really wiped out so much of the American heritage of limited government and watchfulness over government. So if we were ever going to undo this damage, we would have a whole new world in front of us. And the Libertarian Party seems to be the party that really has the principles that should put it in a position to say, you know, we're going down the wrong road with war and surveillance and bankrupting ourselves, trillions of dollars for these so-called wars on terror that just make things worse over in the Middle East and make our economy worse at home, that we really need to go to the root of the problem and rethink 9/11. Because if we ever did, I think we would get a lot more libertarian America out of it. But for some reason, the Libertarian Party hasn't been really quick to figure this out.
Well, in fairness, I don't think any political party has really been quick to figure this out. I think True. The difference in the Libertarian Party is that we tend to draw skeptical individuals. We like to joke within the executive committee that we seem to always have one person who objects to whatever the consensus is, just on principle. And that one person tends to find some reasonable and thoughtful reason, you know, to question whatever we're working on, which isn't a bad thing. It's always good to have somebody who's going to be contrary and looking at this from perhaps a devil's advocate position. But what I'm finding is when I discuss with individuals things like 9/11, I find more times than not, they're libertarian leaning or they're fully libertarian, such as Roth and yourself. And I think this is because, and I don't want to say that libertarians own this, but it seems to me one of the defining things about libertarians is that we've decided to stop being emotionally dragged through issues as the red team and the blue team do. And by the way, for your listeners, I don't call them the Republicans and the Democrats. Those two words mean very, very specific things that neither of those parties represent. I call them the red team and the blue team. They're like a rogue soccer team. So just for your listeners' gratification here, if they're wondering what I'm talking about, when I say the red team and the blue team, that's that. And, you know, we see this constant emotional baiting, and they do this on purpose. And because of that, when you have a very serious issue such as this, people tend to go for the emotional response rather than the intellectual investigation. I've had conversations with friends about 9/11, and I get the same skeptical, you know, Bob, we've already been attacked once. We have to go out there and, you know, free the crap out of other nations. And that's an emotional response. We don't have to go out and attack people. First thing we need to do is stop. And I think it's an important time right now as things are flaring in the Middle East to stop and ask ourselves, what is really the truth about 9/11? Because for your listeners who aren't aware, maybe we should talk about this for just a moment. On 9/11, a third building collapsed, and that building was Building 7. There are some very specific things about Building 7 that people don't know. First of all, Building 7 was over, 300 yards away from Building 1 and Building 2. So we're talking about an entire block. There's actually a building in between Tower 1 and Tower 2 that were hit that did not collapse on 9/11. Two, while it was hit by some of the debris and there were fires, there have been office fires throughout history. And in the history of office fires and building fires of high-rise, modern steel buildings, there has never, exactly zero times in history, have there been collapses of buildings such as World Trade Center 7. Zero. And I think that's really something that can't be overstressed. It's like saying, my car turned into chocolate. In the history of cars, how often is your car ever turned into chocolate? The answer is it's never. And in fact, if my car is at risk of turning into chocolate, I might want to take it back because if I get in an accident and it turns into chocolate, I'm going to die. Well, the same thing is true about World Trade Center 7. It shouldn't have collapsed. We've had buildings who have caught fire that burned longer, that burned hotter, that were much older, and they never collapsed. The fire suppression system of Building 7 should have been sufficient to actually extinguish the fire, and yet it didn't. Why? and that question has not been adequately answered. Office furniture does not burn hot enough to burn to melt steel. And that's a huge, huge issue with Building 7. The second part about Building 7 is what was in Building 7. Building 7 was actually one of the largest aggregation of government offices outside of Washington, D.C. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, it held offices for the U.S. military, for the FBI, for the CIA and the NSA. There were serious levels of government infrastructure that were in Building 7. When it falls and you look at the loss of, let's just call it, intelligence that was in that building, it does strain credulity at this. And the third issue about Building 7 was that this building not just collapsed, but it collapsed in on its own footprint. If you go on YouTube and look, there aren't fake videos of Building 7 collapsing. There are videos of Building 7 collapsing. And when Building 7 collapses, it collapses in the middle in a controlled demolition straight down into its own footprint. And if that happened, as people said it did, that is, the steel melted and it collapsed on itself, it should have collapsed unevenly, unless for some reason the debris that hit from the other buildings somehow found its way into the exact middle of the building, cored down to the very basement of the building, and melted the girders and the structures that hold up the building from the bottom up. And that just doesn't happen. It just does not happen. And so you add all of these things together, and it just says to you, there's something here that just doesn't smell right. And so Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth has a resolution coming up at the upcoming Architects, American Institute of Architects convention. And I believe this is what, May 14th and 15th and 16th?
Sounds right.
Yeah, that calls this into question. Their resolution, which is Resolution 16-5, it's entitled 7 World Trade Center, simply says, we have looked at the science that is used in order to evaluate the collapse of Building 7, and we do not believe they have used the best scientific methodology available. In fact, not just didn't they use the best methodology, what they used was faulty. It strains anybody to ever look at the evidence and say that this is what happened. And the important part of that is that if they are right about why Building 7, if the official story of Building 7's collapse is true, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of buildings around the world that are at risk of collapsing from a fire. And that should get everybody's attention, because if you work in a high-rise in the world, you're at risk of your building collapsing if a fire catches. And that's just not true.
Well, that's a clue that nobody deep down inside really does believe the official story of Building 7, because if they did, there would be a huge retooling of all of the high-rises. You know, wastebasket fires could cause high rises to come down in 7 seconds. You know, it's just that would be a huge threat, but nobody really believes that, because I think that at some level, I think a lot of people sort of know the truth about 9/11, but don't allow themselves to be aware of their own knowledge. I think there's a kind of a strange psychological phenomenon at work here.
There, I would have to agree with that, but I think it is that, you know, I don't even know how you put this in a psychology preface. I'm sure that there's a very technical way that you put this. And perhaps it's just a prolonged degree of shock. But, you know, you mentioned one thing that I didn't mention, which was that the building came down at free fall speed, as if there was no resistance from any of the floors or girders in the building. And, you know, when people look at 9/11, I think there's two sides to this. One is they're still in shock. I can't believe that anybody would just do this or allow this to happen. And they can't get over that. I've spoken to people about 9/11, and they just look at me cross-eyed. But I'll have to admit that for many years after, and I really didn't begin waking up to the reality until probably 2010, 2011, which was part of a broader, awakening that I went through, as many have. It's hard. I remember when I first began to hear people saying that 9/11 was not what we thought, and I went, yeah, oh man, I just can't. I don't think I can bring myself to believe that. I mean, people died. I don't, you know, just you're ruining the memory of these people. You're polluting this terrible moment in time with these conspiracies. And then one day I came across the documentary, Architects and Engineers for 9/11, and I watched the 15-minute short presentation of it. And I remember sitting back in my chair and going, I've been lied to. I gave my support for the war in Iraq. I gave my support for the war in Afghanistan. I gave my support for the war on terror. We had 3,000 people in America die. We've killed over 500,000 people in the Middle East. We have displaced millions more. We have sent terrible, terrible weapons in motion in these countries. We have ruined children's lives with radioactive waste that was part of our ammunition that is causing birth defects. I gave my permission for this. And this was part of all of the things that came together for me and said, I got to leave the red team. I'm clearly not being represented by these people. And so 9/11, I realized, is part of this political movement of things that people are looking for someone to stand up and say, you're right, I will represent you. If you do not believe the true story about the story about 9/11, I will be your representation, and I'm going to begin moving the Libertarian Party in that direction. And it's not a linear path here for the Libertarian Party. There are entities within it who do not want to become ingrained in this because they want to be more mainstream. They're concerned about being considered conspiracy theorists or truthers. You know, that's what they like to call us. Oh, you're a 9/11 truther. No, I'm not. What I am is I'm somebody who's skeptical of the original story, and I think that we owe it to the number, the hundreds of thousands of people that have died, to take a closer look at this and do it not from an emotional standpoint, but from a rational standpoint.
You know, I tried to point out to the libertarians in 2008 and on other occasions that actually with 9/11 we have a pretty big potential audience. The polls show that about a third of the American people have some pretty serious skepticism towards 9/11. There was one poll that found 36%. This was a Scripps poll in 2006, I think. 36% of Americans think it's either likely or very likely that 9/11 was an inside job designed to launch wars in the Middle East. That's a lot of Americans. That's 100 million plus Americans. And libertarians, I think, are drawing, what, I got like 2.5% of
the
vote.
Only getting 2 to 3%, and this right. is what I had to explain to the folks in the room. Look, we're getting through. What are you worried about? You worried about we're going to lose 1% of the vote? We'll gain another 20%. This is one of those issues that it truly can be a single issue voter draw. There are people who will say, you know what, clearly the economy doesn't matter because the red team and the blue team aren't doing anything to fix this. Nobody really is. I mean, the whole argument over gay marriage, let's get past this, call it civil union and move on. We've got a whole bunch of people that are there. But they still vote red team or blue team because they think that there are, you know, no other choices. But if there were an important single issue that the other two parties completely avoid or ignored that was important to these individuals, they would switch. And I think we could easily get 10 to 15% of the vote if we took on some of these difficult issues that aren't being discussed. And I think this is the perfect time to do it, not just because, you know, and I don't mean this from a opportunistic standpoint. Hey, I'm going to take advantage of 9/11's tragedy. I mean, from the amount of information and the number of people who have this in their consciousness, thinking about this issue today has grown so large that I think if we begin to actually talk about this in a legitimate and open way, that we can draw people to the party to begin voting libertarian because they think this is important. And this is something that isn't being addressed and needs to. I'd love to hear Ron Johnson tell me, what do you think happened on 9/11? I want you to get on record, Tammy Baldwin. I want you to get on, these are our U.S. senators. I want you on record. Do you think we know the truth about 9/11? And if not, do you call for new hearings? And if you don't know, then I think the first question we have to ask, and this is the most prescient, tell me, have you looked into and read the 28-page Select Senate report on 9/11, which is really another growing issue within this issue? And I think that's another big part of this that makes this a mainstream issue for libertarians to take up right now. There is more than one angle of what's happening about 9/11 right now.
Well, that's right. Yeah, the missing 28 pages from the joint House-Senate inquiry is a huge issue. It's picked up a fair amount of support in Congress, but hasn't gone to the floor in a vote. And I think the vote would be to ask the president to declassify it. And that report, according to various sources, including Florida Senator Bob Graham, totally overturns the standard view of 9/11 and implicates the Saudis and perhaps other foreign governments as well. But the Saudis are a bit number one. Of course, the problem with this is that the way it's pointing the finger at the Saudis is that these alleged hijackers, 15 out of 19, were from Saudi Arabia, and a group of them was in Southern California living with their FBI handler, and they got they got cut some checks from some Saudi royal family members. Well, but the problem is that this is going to lead to their FBI handler as well as to the Saudi royal family members. So I think that's one reason that, you know, if they could just somehow blame the Saudis in a limited hangout, that might go over with certain elements of the power structure. But if this thing really comes out, these 28 pages, you know, spark a true investigation of what's in those pages, it could start peeling off the whole onion. And that's very threatening. You know, I think one of the issues that a lot of people in the truth movement haven't fully grasped is that it's not just the bad guys who are covering this up. Sure, they're the leading force, but everybody who has a serious stake in the status quo is going to be afraid to deal with this because it threatens massive political instability. It's political dynamite. And if this 9/11 truth bomb goes off in our political system, who knows what's going to come next? So I think a lot of people are just afraid to go there. Even good people who really are not, you know, they would reject the whole idea of doing something like 9/11. They would be appalled, but they're just afraid of what could happen if the truth comes out.
Well, and Zachariah Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker, or was he the 19th?
He would have been the 20th.
He would have been the 20th. Yeah, he's walked into court, and he's already said openly in an affidavit, we were being paid through the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C., and we received money through the Saudi embassy, I believe, in San Diego. And so if that is true, and the Saudi government, even if it's not from the top, even if it comes from inside the Saudi government, underneath the veils of whatever you call the layers of Saudi government, if it's true, that would be not an act of terror. That would have made it an act of war. And so when we start talking about these things, Kevin, what we start seeing is you start getting into the whole conspiracy side of this. You know, what is that truth? What I think is probably best for us to do when we get to this part of the conversation is to say, let's talk about maybe what the largest parts of this could indicate, if true, and we're not from just some sort of rumor. So we don't know what's in the 28 pages. We understand that it may show that there was some ties to Saudi Arabia. We don't know because we haven't read that report, and no one who has read the report can officially come on the record, or else they would violate their oath, and if they did that, they'd be in prison. So let's agree that whatever's in that 28 pages, we don't know. But Zachariah Moussaoui has openly said, I was paid, or we refunded by the individuals in the embassy of the Saudi government. Now, that's important. If that is true, what it does is it puts a different picture on why 9/11 happened. Now, does that mean that someone in the U.S. government said, hey, let's let this happen so we can start a war in the Middle East? I don't think that's quite exactly it. I think a better reason for why 9/11 happened might have been, by the time they figured it out, they had no choice but to let it happen and cover it up. Because if they had exposed it, it would have created such turmoil in the petrodollar that it could have led to the collapse of the petrodollar, which would have been a complete unraveling of the military-industrial complex of the world. And, I mean, we don't have to talk about the black budget nature of our federal government, of our military, but, you know, when you start having an unraveling of the petrodollar, you have a very destabilizing, internationally destabilizing event that I think perhaps it's possible that people in the government said, yeah, we can't have that. It's better to let this happen and use this as an excuse to do something else than to expose it and then prosecute the Saudis for having done this. Because once you destroy the petrodollar, it's game over for the U.S. hegemony.
So can I quickly explain the problem in your thesis?
Sure.
Okay. Well, first, you've already mentioned Building 7. Building 7 was the highest security building in New York. It was the CIA's second headquarters after Langley, Virginia.
There you go.
And the idea that the Saudis would be able to demolish it, and of course demolish the two towers as well, because once you figure out that 7 was demolished, you see that the two towers were demolished. Now, 7 was, I believe, almost a third again taller than the next highest building that had ever been demolished. And of course, the Twin Towers were much higher, taller than that. So the towers were more than three times as tall as the tallest building that had ever been demolished in a controlled demolition before. These were extremely professional jobs, and the idea that the Saudis could somehow come in here and would even want to, why would they want them to come straight down and not damage the surrounding building? So that kind of throws the whole Saudis did it thesis into doubt. But
no,
then
I
more important,
I agree that Building 7 may have been brought down by the U.S. government. I agree with that thesis altogether, because there's no way that anybody else would have had access to the building to use the thermite in order to bring the building down. I concur with that probable scenario wholeheartedly.
But the towers, of
I
course,
think that to help cover it up, yeah, they may have had to take out Building 7. Not that the Saudis took out Building 7.
Right, but see, the tower, it's, if you watch the Architects and Engineers video to the end, you'll see that the towers are even more obvious demolitions than 7 is. You could just look at them. They're blowing up. They're, you know, stuff is being blown upwards and outwards. Some people have suggested that there were miniature nuclear weapons in there. I don't know if that's the case, but something with
We would have had a huge radiation signature if mini nukes.
Modern miniature hydrogen weapons apparently have non-long-lasting small radiation signatures, but that's all classified anyway. But in any case, the bottom line here is that this whole 28-page memo that points at these 15 out of 19 alleged hijackers getting funded from Saudi Arabia while they were living with their FBI handler is, in fact, utterly irrelevant to the damage that was done on 9/11, because if there's one thing that we know for sure about 9/11, it is that none of those 19 guys were even on the planes. We are 100% sure of that, because had they been on the planes, we would have had authenticated security camera footage, none of which has ever been produced. We would have had testimony from the airline employees who boarded them and ticketed them, and that has never been produced. We would have had authenticated ticket stubs, and that's never been produced. And we would have had the standard authenticated passenger lists that are kept as records from every plane flight, and those have never been produced either. Only some informal passenger lists that were given to the media, which don't even match up with each other. That's all that we have to tell us who was supposedly on those planes, and not one Arab name is on any of those lists. Given all of that, and given the fact that not one of those four allegedly hijacked planes squawked the hijack code, which takes less than 2 seconds, and that the military trained pilots, special forces trained in one case, the Chip Burlingame, who was on 77, these pilots were supposedly overcome by, we were told, muscle hijackers. These muscle hijackers were 5 foot tall, 120 pound shrimp weaklings with no particular military or combat ability. The idea that, and the best pilot was Hani Hanjour, who was not allowed to fly a Cessna because he couldn't even drive. He was basically a mentally retarded patsy who couldn't even drive. They wouldn't let him solo in a Cessna. He's the guy they said was the best pilot of any of the four hijacker pilots. And the maneuver that was made to hit the Pentagon could not have been done by any human, much less him. All of the passengers, including the pilot, would have been rendered unconscious by the G-forces. The story that there were hijackers has been disproven not just 7 ways from Sunday, but way beyond that. And so the notion that because 15 Saudi hijackers were getting paid by the Saudi government, this means the Saudis did it as an act of war, that's ludicrous. The idea that the Saudis as a government would have anything to gain from doing something like this is equally ludicrous.
It's, you know, this is all part of the great mystery about 9/11. I think, you know, on most levels, Kevin, we're on the same page. We don't know what we don't know until a proper investigation has been done. And we don't know until somebody outside of the government has been tasked with actually looking into this properly. And without having access to these classified documents, there's no way to know.
Well, I would argue there is. I think we pretty much know what happened at this point, but that's, you know, maybe I'm talking because I've been studying this intensively since late 2003. But, you know, I think it's not so much a matter of knowing, it's a matter of sort of who will bail the cat, right? Because, you know, we have a deep state apparatus that has been largely in control of our government probably since 1913, when the Federal Reserve coup d'etat happened, certainly since 1963, when they killed the president, in 68, when they killed his brother, who would have been president. So I think that that's the situation that we're facing, is that, you know, we have a platonic class of guardians. Plato said that every polity needed a class of people who dedicated themselves completely to guarding that polity against internal and external enemies. But the question is, who will guard the guardians? Well, we have a class of guardians that's not being guarded, and they're totally out of control. And we need to face that. And I think that's really the value of 9/11, if we can really expose it, is to change that system, to basically overthrow this deep state that's taken over our country. And I think we already do know the outlines of how the deep state has taken over our country, if we spend the time to study it. And then the question is, who will bell the cat? Who will find a way to take down this deep state?
Well, that's exactly right. I think the beginning and the chinks in that armor are being showed by Edward Snowden. In particular, recently, the court ruling just this last week that showed that mass surveillance of U.S. citizens' phones is actually unconstitutional. And I think that we're starting to see the breakup and the defeat of this surveillance state. And it's just the beginning of it. And I think there will be a crisis of confidence coming up. And I think that in this crisis of confidence, we're going to find out a lot of things that the American people are going to be very surprised about. And I don't think it'll just be about 9/11. I think there'll be a whole host of things that are going to come forward that will significantly surprise the public, that they were being not just misled on, but things that were being done that weren't just illegal, but were criminal, world criminal-like.
And I agree completely. I've been actually focusing on these kinds of issues I've done a lot of radio interviews with the people who've been involved in some of these things. And frankly, it's quite stunning how much of this material, which is entirely credible, implicates high-level people in just an incredible series of crimes, what we call state crimes against democracy. That's what the academicians are calling it these days, the people who are studying this new field, SCADs. And there are SCADs of them out there. It really does seem that we have a class of people who think that they're above the law and have pointed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's to me, it's just criminal. It's why I gave up my support for the Red Team. Why I woke up one day and I said, I can't support these people. They fundamentally are not doing their job. They fundamentally are not making the hard decisions and the hard choices. And I began by making that call on, you know, economic grounds. You know, well, okay, listen, guys, you're, you know, at that time, we were $13 trillion in debt. You got to do something about this. And they refused to do anything about it. And I said, all right, I'm leaving the party. And at the same time, I started to look at some of these other issues, and I realized not only was I right for leaving the party over economic issues, I was right for leaving the party over national security issues, over social issues. There's just a whole host of things that were good reasons to leave the two-party system, and this one to me is just the tip of the spear that could truly burst the bubble on a two-party system, which is really only a one-party system.
And I think it leads to a place where libertarians can kind of use what would otherwise be a weak area of weakness as a strength, and that is economics. You know, I think that it's hard to convince sort of your average voter in this time of really savage inequality and generally stagnant economy. More polarization of wealth, the rich getting richer, everybody else being left behind. It's hard to convince them that, well, let's get rid of labor unions, and let's get rid of government programs, let's get rid of food stamps and Social Security, let's go to a sort of dog-eat-dog free market system. And a lot of people are going to just say, well, isn't that what we've been doing in the last 30 years, and look how it's working out for us. So libertarians, I think, have a tough argument in terms of practical economic policy. But with 9/11, I think that leads us to a place where we can actually win, which is to point out that the damage to our economy of these wars, these multi-trillion dollar useless wars, has been enormous, and that government is the enemy of economic prosperity in the big picture. Right. So this is an area where we can attack the way the government has destroyed our economy from libertarian principles and make an economic argument that's going to make sense to people.
I concur wholeheartedly. In fact, I think a great example of how our energies and our financial benefits are being eroded is with this, you know, F-35 debacle. I mean, $300 million a plane. Are you kidding me? You know, this is just a ridiculous, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I've been doing lately is really focusing on history and learning some history and going through this. And I don't think most people understand that these wars do not work for people's benefits. And this one in particular that we've been ingrained in, this war on terror, which is an unwinnable war. It will be in this forever. We need to take a completely different tack on this, which is why I supported Ron Paul so deeply. But, you know, take, for example, World War One. What people won't understand about World War One was Europe had spent, you know, almost 100 years at peace with itself. And in those 100 years, the level of economic prosperity that the people enjoyed in those 100 years was unrivaled in the history of Europe. This could happen for us as well. Give up the war on terror. You know, we need to attack this from a completely different, dismantle the war machine. We do not, you look, we're trying to defeat, you know, maybe a couple thousand terrorists with millions of people involved in a war machine, and we're not going to solve it that way. It's just not going to happen. And what we're doing in the interim is we're just destroying the economic prosperity of our nation and of the world. And I think it's time to take a new direction.
I think that makes sense. Rolf Lindgren, my libertarian acquaintance, also talks a lot about the 19th century being a century of prosperity, more so than the 20th. And I think that there is a historical case that that's true, and that at the beginning of the 20th century, there were a number of things, including the Federal Reserve becoming a money monopoly, and then World War One coming along, that sent America down a different path, a path of the warfare welfare state, which is not working out so well. And interestingly, World War One was launched with this Lusitania public relations event that is parallel to the what happened at Pearl Harbor and then what happened on 9/11. We've had three world wars in the last century: World War One, World War II, and this current war on Islam or war on terror, whatever you want to call it. And interestingly, all three were sold to the American people with images of horrific disasters killing a couple thousand people. And then this was blamed on the ostensible enemy. With the Lusitania, I just did a radio show on this with James Perloff, a historian who discusses how it was orchestrated by the British more than anyone else. The Lusitania was loaded with armaments and passengers and sent straight to a U-boat to be sunk. And Pearl Harbor was the result of the Roosevelt administration's 8-point plan to force the Japanese to strike first. And they knew that it was coming, and they sent the aircraft carriers out to sea and left the men on the mothballed battleships to be slaughtered. That was an intentional sacrifice of 2,000 people.
A very little known fact. You're absolutely right. The old ships were all put in Pearl Harbor. The good brand new ones, the diamonds of the fleet, were all out. We cut off the oil supply to Japan. We did exactly what Japan would need to be spurred into attacking us. And unquestionably, Roosevelt knew what he was doing when he started, poking at that tiger. And at the same time, Japan knew when they bombed Pearl Harbor, many of the generals knew this was probably not the smartest thing for us to do. But it was, you know, very, very small numbers of elite people at the very top, taking people to war and knowing that the easiest way to do it, much like Lincoln in Fort Sumter, knew that what you have to do is you have to provoke the enemy into attacking first by doing that which you know will make them most apt to do that. And this is what happens. And when we go into the Middle East and we ask, you know, the thing that's missed about 9/11 is nobody bothers to ask, why did they attack if the story is true, that it was the Saudis or that it was, you know, Islamic fundamentalism, terrorism. Nobody's actually bothered to stop and ask, why are they trying to destroy buildings in New York? Look, we have so involved ourselves in the Middle East, in the petrodollar, in the lives of these Muslims, that a lashing out is actually quite understandable. We should have disconnected from the petrodollar and gone back on the gold standard when Ronald Reagan had the chance in the early to mid-80s. And he chose not to, because he decided that it was easier to get out of the recession that Carter was handed by going with a trickle-down fiat currency model, and it worked for him. It worked for, you know, 4 or 5 years. He got reelected in 84. He was able to get George W. Bush elected in 88. And I think, unfortunately, I think Bush maybe after the Cold War was over thought, well, you know, maybe we can start paring this back. I actually joined the Air Force in 88 and I got out in 1990. I got in on the Reagan buildup and I got out on the Bush cutbacks that he cut back about 40,000 people from the military, which I think actually caused the recession that caused George W. Bush to lose the 1992 election. It wasn't just Ross Perot. If the economy had been in great shape, then there would have been no reason for Bush to lose that election. But, you know, these people in the Middle East, we really need to take, it isn't that we're taking an isolationist position, we're taking a non-intervention position, but we have our hooks in so many nations over there that we just give ourselves, we leave ourselves open to being attacked. You know, why are we worried about ISIS in America? Well, look, we're still in Afghanistan. We're still in Iraq. We're helping Saudi Arabia and Yemen. We're talking about attacking in Syria. We've been attacking in Syria. We're probably involved in Oman. We're down in Somalia. We've got, you know, 179 direct bases around the world. We've got, you know, more than 800 stations throughout the world. Look, it's time to admit that we have overstretched ourselves. We are in too many places trying to control the world, and it's time for us to stop. We can't be the world's policemen, nor should we be, and we're going to have to accept that we need to be part of a broad coalition through the UN if we ever get involved so that we take the target off of our back. That's the only way we're going to get over this whole war on terror.
Well, I agree completely. And there's one aspect of this issue that most people in public positions tend to really shy away from, in the same way they shy away from the issue of what really happened in 9/11. That is the extent of Israeli control over U.S. Middle East policy. This was something I already knew about when 9/11 happened because I was studying Arabic and Islamic studies. That was my field. And you quickly discover that people from that region have a very different view of what's going on in Israel-Palestine than what we get in the media. And then you start scratching a little deeper and you learn that about half of the money that flows in as campaign contributions or bribes, whatever you want to call them, to federal candidates comes from Israeli, you know, Zionist donors who are buying up our Congress and our presidency. And you learn...
It is.
You learn that the media is, according to various studies, including as well as testimonials from people like Philip Weiss, who's Jewish himself, worked for New York Times and many other places, that he says about half of all of the key people, the reporters and his bosses and owners of the places he's worked, like the New York Times, have been Jewish, and that they're all fanatically devoted to pushing the Israeli narrative, feeling that they're sort of the last line of defense of this beleaguered country. So given that kind of power, and let's not forget the hundreds of millionaires and dozens of billionaires supporting 500,000 fanatical activists working to keep the U.S. subservient to Israel's Middle East policy, and you have a formula for kind of what was going on in France under de Gaulle, when the colons in Algeria, the people who were absolutely committed to keeping Algeria French, were the ones who were forcing the French to keep its forces in Algeria at war. And they kept trying to even kill the president and stage a coup d'etat because de Gaulle wasn't radical enough for, you know, cracking down on the Algerian Muslims on behalf of the settler colonialists there. Well, today we have settler colonialists squatting over in occupied Palestine. They have tremendous power here in the United States. And as I've studied this issue over the past decade, I've come to the conclusion that's the single biggest factor behind 9/11 and the war on terror, is that what this really was a coup d'etat against the government of the United States by the neoconservative Likudnik right-wing faction of Israelis, who used it to use the American military to smash up the Middle East on behalf of Israel. And that's something you're not allowed to talk about in the mainstream discourse.
You're not, because the moment you begin talking about Israel, people say, well, you're just being anti-Semitic. You're being, you know, you're hating, you know, the people of the Jewish faith. And it needs to be said very clearly. I have many friends who are Jewish. I have absolutely no problem with people of the Jewish faith. I actually think many of them are wonderful people. They're great people. I love them dearly. But as you said, what people don't know in particular is that what drives Israeli policy is Zionism. It is not about race. It is a political movement. However, Zionism in and of itself is made up of individuals of the Jewish faith who believe and are racist that the Jews are the superior race and have every right to kill every single Palestinian in order to take every square inch of the country of Israel back. We have now gotten documents released from Glenn Greenwald that show a concerted effort by the Israeli government to keep the Palestinian economy at as low yet sustainable level as they possibly can. In other words, do not allow the Palestinian people to have any more of an economy than is allowable as a subsistence economy needs to be.
They were even counting the calories.
Yes, that is an actual policy of the Israeli government. We should be outraged that any of this is happening and that even a dollar of our taxes are going to the Israeli government. Period, sentence, paragraph, chapter, novel. This thing needs to stop tomorrow. In fact, one of my heroes who really opened me up to this was also from Glenn Greenwald's The Intercept, which is Murtaza Hussein, who writes about that. We do not in America get the story of the Palestinians. And I was absolutely appalled. Three young, bright Jewish boys were murdered last fall during the election, and it was terrible. The Israelis used that excuse to kill literally, 1,300 Palestinians. And I'm sorry, I'm going to say this. What psychopath thinks that that's an appropriate response to three deaths? What kind of psychopath is Benjamin Netanyahu? I want that question asked, and I want Americans to begin looking at this. It has nothing to do with him being Jewish. It has to do with him being a Zionist. It is a political and a racist movement. I am against racism, and I am against the death occurring in Palestine. And you are right. One of the primary reasons that New York was attacked is it is seen as a center for the monetary global power base that supports Israel.
Well,
this is why Americans are dying.
I think New York was attacked because a certain mafia owns the place, and so they could get away with it.
Sure, we can split up 10 different ways until we know what the actual truth is. So I think you're absolutely right that at a very core part of this is Israel, and from a historical standpoint, I don't know if you follow how much you follow podcasts or YouTube, folks. One of my favorite individuals is a philosopher by the name of Stefan Molyneux. You can find him his YouTube channel and podcast channel is Free Domain Radio, and he did a wonderful piece on the truth about Israel. I think that's what it's called. You can actually look it up. But go to Free Domain Radio or look up Stefan Molyneux. He's a Canadian. And he talks about the formation of Israel and how this whole thing has come together. And it's an amazing piece of history that I don't think most people understand of how this formed and came together and really how this has led to where we are today, that this whole thing really began in the 1800s. This whole war between Muslims and Jews in Israel does not go back thousands of years. And in fact, for hundreds, if not even 1,000 years, there was actually relative peace between the two religions until the mid to late 1800s, when Zionism began to establish itself and calling Jews to move back to Israel and calling them in and saying, come live here, we're going to take over the area. And there were Jews in the country who actually railed against that and said, hold on, no. We're actually living in relative peace and safety here. We don't want this to start right now. We're not looking for this. And yet it continued to progress because of the money that was infiltrated into there. And it's really a piece of history that I recommend people study if you want to understand global economic politics today.
Indeed. And there are a lot of interesting sort of slightly esoteric aspects of this that are not always fully covered in the history books, although sometimes you hear about some of this. But for instance, the Balfour Declaration, when the British said that if we win World War I, and steal Palestine from the Ottomans, we will establish a homeland for the Jews there. That was the agreement that they made. And it was apparently Lord Rothschild who cut that deal with the British leaders by promising them victory in World War I, by presumably both using financial power to help the British win. At that time, the British were planning to call off World War I and go back to the status quo ante. But Rothschild said, we can give you victory. We'll leverage the money to your side, and we'll bring America into the war on your side. So that was how Israel was created, was through this Balfour Declaration. Interestingly, Americans lost, 50,000 plus lives in that war, apparently mainly to help the British win so that Palestine could be stolen from the Ottomans and handed to the Zionists.
Yes, and it's interesting because these world wars have created much of the problems that we deal with today because of how they ended and because of these divisions. You know, for example, World War II. After World War II, there were brand new political lines that were created. I mean, Iraq, for example, was, and in a lot of respects, even Iran, were manufactured zones after World War II. The reason that we lost so badly and were beaten so badly we went into Iraq was we didn't understand that this was an area that was really chunked together politically from a bunch of disparately separate tribes who didn't get along. But the reason they were conglomerated into a single country was after World War II, we just drew new political lines. We didn't care who was who or where they were from. And, you know, when you lost that control after we attacked Iraq, you saw all of these internal strifes it re-explode again. And it's uncontrollable unless you have, you know, someone who's willing to exert just an awful level of power like Saddam Hussein did. I think he was a terrible man, but at the same time, he may have had the only viable political plan to control Iraq.
Possibly. Yeah, my view is that since the Islamic Awakening, which has, you know, been picking up steam for quite some time, and its showpiece was the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, the people of the Islamic world have kind of drifted back into their natural political identity, which is to identify first as Muslims, and then secondarily as people of whatever tribe or nation may have been set up for them. And in many cases, as you suggest, these nations were actually carved out by the European imperial and colonial powers. And so there's this Islamic awakening where people are kind of getting back to their primarily Islamic identity and identifying as members of the Islamic Ummah or pan-Islamic nation. And I think that there are certain world powers, primarily the Zionists, but also to some extent other Western leaders are worried about this, because if this actually succeeds in uniting the Islamic lands, that they're going to control most of the world's high-grade energy resources. So that's considered a possible geostrategic threat. Plus, they're opposed to usury, which means that to the extent that any Islamic country or supranational entity or caliphate or whatever happens to be Islamic, it's not going to accept the kind of fiat currency banking in which money is created out of nothing by lending it into existence at interest. This is the worst form of riba, one of the very worst sins in Islam. So I think there's that level of kind of a strategic threat in the long term from the Islamic world that's part of the reason for this war on Islam. But as a libertarian and as somebody who wants to treat other people fairly, I think just as here in the United States, we have a system of kind of secular respect for all different faiths that's working okay. I think that the people in Islamic countries who have their own particular Islamic traditions should also be allowed self-determination, and to if their aspirations are to live in an Islamically governed society, that's precisely what they should be allowed to do. And I think
absolutely.
And so why are we over there just smashing things up and driving people crazy?
Well, and I think that part of that as well, and I think we saw this clearly when you do your research on it, we saw this clearly in Libya. The problem was that Muammar Gaddafi wanted to go back to a gold standard dinar to trade in oil, and I think that there would have been a movement amongst Middle East countries in order to do that, which I think, frankly, for stability within the countries of the Middle East would have been a great thing, and I don't think that America wanted that. I think America knew that if we started, if there was a movement afoot to return to a gold standard currency, it could upset the ability for countries to control, and that was a real problem for, I think, for the American politicians, and especially
and the bankers
when you look
who own them.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And if you look at Egypt, you know, the reason Mubarak was deposed, and most people don't know this, was inflation. Food inflation skyrocketed in Egypt, and that's what caused the Arab Spring. It had nothing else to do with that but the cost of food. Most people there lived on $3, $4 a day, and when the cost of food goes up 30%, yeah, you're going to have riots. That's what happens.
Indeed. Well, you know, we're hitting the end of the hour, but it's been great. You know, this is one of the best conversations with the Wisconsin Libertarian since the days of Ed Thompson. May he rest in peace. Ed's one of my heroes. And Robert Burke, a candidate for governor of Wisconsin in 2014. I appreciate your hardcore truth-telling and your unusual common sense, and I wish you the best in continuing to awaken libertarians to the truth movement and to standing up for truth, justice, and the American way. So keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Kevin. And I'd encourage people right now, please like the Libertarian Party of Wisconsin's Facebook page if you're involved. And we're going to have more people that are going to be joining the party. We're growing, and it's an exciting time. So come join us, and we're looking for candidates for 2016 coming up this fall.
Okay, sounds like a plan. I might even think about that myself. Well, thank you so much, Robert.
Thanks, Scott.
Great conversation. Appreciate it.
Last plane missed the